Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with regional and national writers from North State Public Radio. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
What happens when a burned-out professor trades academia for a fresh start in the city of her dreams? Rebecca Knuth retired from the University of Hawaii in 2014. She moved to London for 2 years and reinvented herself by taking courses in creative nonfiction and tour guiding. She was an expert in cultural destruction and censorship. Rebecca Knuth has presented at national and international conferences, published in academic journals, and given interviews and editorials to Smithsonian Magazine and Canadian Broadcasting Corporation Radio. She has been a lecturer on cruise ships like Cunard's Queen Elizabeth. She has now written a memoir of reinvention, resilience, and self-discovery. The title is London Sojourn, Rewriting Life After Retirement. Rebecca Knuth, welcome.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here.
Well, I'm going to jump right into the very middle of your book. And this is chapter 7, Rebecca. And the title of this chapter intrigues me, and I don't think many people know the meaning or have ever even heard of the word that is the title of this chapter. Would you tell listeners what this word is that they may never have heard of?
The word is flaneuring, and it came from a book from a couple years. It's almost been a decade by Lauren Elkin. And she goes to various cities, I think Paris is one of them, and wanders around seeking stimulation, just the idiosyncratic nature of what she sees. And it's a way of looking at things where you're open to both the mental and the visual stimuli.
You even, under the title Flaneur, and you say, quote, "Perhaps I'm also a flaneuse." And this word has a masculine and a feminine. And when I was telling a friend of mine about your being a flaneuse and told him he wasn't familiar with the word, and he said, "Oh, that's what I want to do." He even picked out the city he would go to be a flaneur. And so I think that people would find this appealing, particularly if they've spent a life focusing on achievement like you have. To be a flaneur would be maybe a difficult challenge. Did you find it difficult, Rebecca?
You know, I was doing it without being able to name what I was doing. But it came from this deep desire not to be totally conscribed and sort of same old, same old. I had this desire to open up and see things differently and to experience London differently. I did not find it difficult. I found it exhausting.
To be idle? You find idleness exhausting?
Well, what I managed to do with flaneuring is to transform it into something driven, which is what I'm very good at. So, you know, I would get Elkin's book and take a page from her experiences and then look at mine and see what is more in line with a person's natural inclinations and then go for it.
So I think people will enjoy your chapter on flaneuring. So we've jumped into how you happen to be. You're already in London. And so let's go back to how this all came about. So I'm going to ask you to read a paragraph in your book, if you don't mind, Rebecca. And this is when you tell us how you progressed in your career to become a full professor. Would you read that paragraph, please?
Okay. In competition, mostly with myself, I studied what it took to get rank and doubled the normal production of papers and services. Women had to do more. I began as an assistant professor, moved up to associate level, and then to full professor. But after almost 2 decades at the University of Hawaii, I was disgusted with university politics and academic writing and felt restless, stagnant, and apathetic.
This is my guest, retired professor Rebecca Knuth, and she just read a paragraph from her book, London Sojourn, Rewriting Life After Retirement. Rebecca, one of the sentences in this paragraph said, women had to do more. And I thought it was interesting when a retired professor friend of mine asked what I was doing. I said, I'm reading this really interesting book about this retired professor. And his question was, what is his name? I thought, now that illustrates your whole point. You just said women had to do more because his expectation was, well, this was a man who was the author. And so I was delighted to tell him that the author's name is Rebecca Knuth.
Which speaks for itself. Yes, I found that, especially when starting out and trying to make tenure, I would carefully investigate what it seemed to take to make rank and to be productive, and then I doubled it.
Yeah.
So that's where I started with this driven material, this driven approach to life, because I just felt I had so much to learn and in a way so much to prove. And part of that was because I was a woman.
And you say in your book, what I really wanted to do was change my life significantly. And that's a rather difficult goal, I would think, Rebecca. And even as I say your name, I'm thinking, well, some people with the name Rebecca go by Becky, but that doesn't fit you, I don't think.
Well, it's interesting because actually I go by both, but Rebecca was always the academic name. And then when I went to London, some of the people called me Rebecca in certain roles, and some of the time with friends, it was Becky. And now I'm now that I'm a full-time writer, I've reverted a lot back to Rebecca for professional things because it has a certain gravitas. Let's face it, Becky doesn't.
Well, there's so many times when I'm reading your book, I think, oh, me too. You even use a verb that I don't think I've heard anybody else use, but early in your book, you say, this is when you were a kid,
mm-hmm.
And you say, I had stumbled blindly into new possibilities and identities with my trip at age 12. You're 12 years old, and you say you stumbled into new possibilities. And that's the way I've thought so many times in my life. I felt like I just stumbled in the right direction. Didn't know really what I was doing, but I stumbled in the right direction. And you quote your roommate. Yeah. Do you remember what your roommate told you?
Yes. She said that you don't know what you can't do.
Yes.
And I have followed that ever since. You know, people say defining things to you. Like I had a professor who defined me as an intelligent woman who can handle tremendous amounts of material. And I've always tried to live up to that. But this idea that you don't know what you can't do is a really good way to approach things. And it allows for stumbling, because stumbling implies that you're moving. And you may not always know in what direction or path you are going, but you are moving towards something, and you're hoping to find out sometimes what that something is.
And that's one of the times when I said, oh, me too. That's I use that very verb myself, stumbled. So that, I think, is good advice for people to kind of, maybe they'll want to take that as their motto. I don't know what I can't do. Well, you go to London and you become a student because you want to become a writer, not an academic writer, but a writer for a popular writer.
That's right.
So when you get there, you enroll in this course. So I'm going to ask you if you would read when you're in London and you're making your way through the tube, and you had to find the right building for your classroom. Would you read that paragraph in your book, Rebecca?
Sure. After difficulties in finding the right building and classroom, I joined my classmates for our first CNF class. Julie Wheelwright, the program director, informs us that classes will be held on two nights a week. Her Tuesday night class will focus on theory and writing. We'll do practice essays and reflect on our own and our classmates' work. On alternative Wednesdays in literary criticism, Peter Moore, an author and graduate of the program, leads discussions on assigned books and nonfiction techniques as applied to biography, travel, history, life writing, and true crime. I learned to read like a writer. Then every other Wednesday, we'll meet with other city creative writing groups for sessions on storytelling, a key concept.
This is Rebecca Knuth, and she's reading from her memoir, London Sojourn, Rewriting Life After Retirement. And you even explained why you use the word sojourn. Why did you choose that word, Rebecca?
Sojourn implies that you're going on some sort of experiential journey where you're going to learn something and that you're there in a purposeful sort of way. And I like the sound of it. You know, various times people have said they liked it, they didn't like it, but I liked it and I stuck with it. It also implies that it's not necessarily forever. And I use sojourn, but I also think of the whole experience as kind of a quest. And in a quest, of course, you leave your normal surroundings, you experience new things, sometimes hardships, and you return changed or you become changed. So this was a sojourn where I learned something and a quest where I became changed.
Now, you just used the word quest, and I was married 45 years to, my husband was a professor at Indiana University.
Uh-huh.
And that should sound familiar to you. Another time I could say, me too. But he lived the life of an academic. So the things you describe in your book, I thought, gosh, yes, she's telling the truth there. I experienced it with my husband. And he used the word quest. He wrote a lot of books, but one of them was Walking the Way, a Medieval Quest. So he used that very word you were just using in his title, because he and I walked the Camino de Santiago de Compostela.
Oh.
So I'm a certified pilgrim. But you use this word quest, and I thought that was interesting that you used that word. And tell listeners again why that word is a key word for you.
That's a key word, because the whole thing about a memoir is that you experience something and you're changed by it. And that's the nature of quests. The quest is to find something about yourself or find some sort of treasure or experience. And that is a significant thing that makes you a different person. And that's why I use the word quest. Plus, in narrative nonfiction and memoir, it's often written in the form of a quest, whether the person says it implicitly or not. And I found it was a good way to kind of frame my experience and also my writing of the memoir.
Well, you know what I found when I walked the Camino, because I thought I was doing my husband a favor, and what you just described, yes, I didn't expect to be changed, Rebecca. I did not expect to be changed, but you're absolutely right. That result of a quest can be life-changing.
And, you know, I think of my life as a series of quests.
Mm-hmm.
And that you have different quests at different times in your life. Life is not just one quest, although you could maybe frame it that way if you had a significant theme. But if you're out trying to become all that you can be or develop yourself, you're going through quests multiple times.
You know, at one point you say the sentence, I kissed a lot of frogs.
Oh.
And this was in the section when you described that you were married for 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
Because in this next section I'm going to ask you to read, the listeners will know who these people are you're referring to. But you say that after 2 years being married to Bill, he was a nice guy, but you were lonely. You were lonely in your marriage, Rebecca?
Yes, I was lonelier, I think, than in a way I'd ever been. And part of it is I think in my nature that I'm very good company for myself. And I really like, you know, the autonomy, but I felt I was being somebody. When I was married, I felt like I was performing, and that really wasn't who I was essentially as a person. He was a really nice guy. I have a wonderful son that came out of the whole experience, but I really don't believe marriage is for me.
Well, I thought it was interesting what your dad asked you. Rebecca, yeah. You got divorced? Who's going to take care of you?
I know, which is so ironic because of the two of us, my husband and I was definitely the one kind of steering the ship. But that was sort of emblematic of my father's sort of attitude toward me and then women in general.
Another time I found his question interesting because the way my husband-to-be proposed to me is he says, I want to take care of you.
Mm-hmm.
And he really did. I mean, I didn't go through what you went through as far as feeling like I was a second-class citizen being a woman, but that's the way he proposed. And your dad says, Rebecca, who's going to take care of you?
Yeah. Yes.
And so I was amused by that reaction. Now, I mentioned that we have Indiana University in common, and you liked the fact that it was a small town. So you get a degree from Indiana University, and you go to the University of Hawaii, and you're a professor there. So why would you want to give up that? Oh, Hawaii, Rebecca.
Oh, okay. So I did love Bloomington, Indiana, and I was there for the 3 years getting the doctorate, whereupon I returned to Hawaii, the University of Hawaii, and a program that I had actually gotten a master's in maybe 5 years before. Now, I was at Hawaii for 18 years, and in my heart, I think I never really belonged. And so I didn't have that emotional connection I had with London, even though I had been in London much less time than I was ever in Hawaii. And when it came to retiring, I knew I wanted something different than staying there. A lovely place, lovely people, just not me.
My guest is Rebecca Knuth, and she has written a memoir, the title, London Sojourn, Rewriting Life After Retirement. We'll be back to continue our conversation after a short break. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, retired professor Rebecca Knuth, who has written a memoir about her time in London. Now, I mentioned that having gotten married and you had the son and your son gets married. So I'm going to ask you to read, you're in London now, going back to your class that you want to reinvent yourself as a popular writer rather than academic writer. So would you read the section where you get emails from your daughter-in-law? Your daughter-in-law's name is Tia. So would you read that section, Rebecca?
Okay. My daughter-in-law emails me her thoughts on shyness and vulnerability. Tia wants to speak up in group situations and practice mindfulness, perhaps share herself with me. I reply that I struggle with these same issues and thoughts. It has taken me 60 years to realize that writing feelings down is a way of exploring them. Writing involves risk and exposure and can leave us raw, but stimulates growth. This year, I plan to open up, lighten up, play more. Some might say that those things don't have anything to do with vulnerability, but I believe they do. Beginning a new program is stressful, and the massive amount of self-scrutiny I'm putting myself through isn't helped by negativity, so I sit on the other side of the room from a few complainers and begin assessing my classmates. Developing a sense of them matters because I will be revealing myself to them, for better or worse, and they to me. In academia, community proved an illusion. Could I find it among my fellow students? I wanted so much to bond and form a band of comrades.
This is my guest, Rebecca Knuth. She was just reading from her memoir, London Sojourn, Rewriting Life After Retirement. And people might wonder, well, academic writing, how is that any different from popular writing? Well, there was kind of a joke. I would go with my husband because we were in the same field. To say a modern language conference, and the speaker would almost seem like bragging that so few people would be interested in reading their book because it was so limited to, it was so narrow that average person would not be interested in reading it. And that's not the kind of writing you wanted to do. Am I correct in that?
That's absolutely correct. And it's actually become a major theme in my life because I feel that there are a lot of lots of constriction in academic writing, and I have been spending years trying to tease out what those constrictions are and how people who are interested in creativity can retrain themselves to be popular writers. So I have a running diary of thoughts on this, and in the next year or two, we'll be writing an article or perhaps even a book about the differences between academic writing and popular writing and the things that I had to learn the hard way.
Well, I did mention when I introduced you that besides your course in creative nonfiction writing, that you were a guide. You were a tour guide. And you mentioned, and specifically by name, a cemetery in London. So I instantly emailed a friend of mine who's written a lot of books on cemeteries. So I thought, well, I don't remember him writing a book about this particular cemetery. And so I told her who my guest would be. And he said, well, I thought about writing a book on this cemetery that she mentions, but I was going to include it in a book about the Magnificent Seven.
Oh, that's seven. There are seven old, interesting cemeteries in London. And so oftentimes when people talk about Highgate Cemetery, which is my personal love of my life.
Now, excuse me, I'm going to repeat that. Highgate Cemetery. Highgate, okay.
It's an old Victorian cemetery that is now open to the public and gives tours. And I volunteered there for a year and showed people around, talked about the cemetery. I led one tour, but it's very dear to my heart. And there's quite a lot of talk about that volunteer experience in the book.
I think people would be surprised at what is involved in becoming a tour guide, Rebecca, at least in London, your experience. And what did you have to do to become, well, you were a volunteer, so you weren't getting paid, but what did you have to do to qualify? And I even was surprised about that word, qualify as a tour guide.
Well, you don't always have to. It varies from where you want to be a guide at. I took a 9-month course at the University of Westminster, and it was strenuous.
Yes, a 9-month course just to be a tour guide. Oh, well, so you shouldn't say just to be. But yeah, I think that's surprising. And you say it was not an easy course.
Oh, it was very hard and demanding, and you had tests, and you had classroom where you learned about the areas, and then you learned to structure the tour, your own personal tour, in terms of like 14 stops. And you would go out on Saturdays with a group, and you would practice giving. They're actually composed of 4-minute presentations put together to make a long a tour of a particular area. You had to have a theme. You had to concentrate on interesting tidbits of information. You had to illuminate the experience. And what I found was that presenting as a tour guide is very much like writing nonfiction. And I learned a lot from that experience of how to process information. And that's what interests me, is how do you convey information and facts and anecdotes to a general audience? And that's what I wanted to do. And tour guiding helped me to achieve that on a much different level.
And I wouldn't have expected that. You know, I would have thought they were two separate, tour guiding and popular writing. So you were saying that, yeah, that your tour guiding informed your writing. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. Yeah. And the other thing that informed my writing was that I was interviewed and I was now doing cruise ship lectures. And there were PowerPoint presentations on various cultural topics. Like I did Australia, so I did the destruction of Aborigine culture and the convict culture and things like that. And I found that structuring those presentations in terms of PowerPoint, where you go in and you talk to the particular theme and having to have an overall theme and narrative, that also helped me to understand how I could structure information more popularly. It was storytelling. I mean, guiding and cruise ship writing, cruise ship lecturing and writing creative nonfiction, it's all storytelling. And that's what academics don't do for the most part.
Yeah. Well, there were so many quotes. I wrote pages of quotes. I thought, oh, I like that quote. That for example, the fact that when you say I'm energized by being alone, but you say, for example, there was a quote, you quoted Proust, and I happen to like French literature. So I looked up, you quoted it in English, but I looked up what he actually wrote in French because I like the quote so much. And you quoted Proust by saying, let us be grateful to people who make us happy. Let us be grateful to people who make us happy. And somebody who comes to mind, a friend of yours in London, was named Tony, Tony Olden. And you dedicated your book to more than one person, but he was the first one you named. You dedicated your book to Tony Olden. And who was Tony?
Tony was had been a former colleague. He was a professor. I met him at a conference, and we had certain subject areas in common, and we had developed a friendship over all my trips to England. And so when I did this two-year experience, he was kind of fully on board, and we would do a lot of our flaneuring, a lot of our long walks along the Thames and going to exhibits and various experiences. We did them together, but I dedicated to him as a boon companion because he was the person that I would run things by or make a joke with. He gave me a sense of that I had continuity, and I really loved that. And we shared a sense of humor.
Well, I share something in common with Tony. And another time when I said, hey, me too, I would like to go out to eat with Tony because what was his, that he ate a lot of, what kind of food did he eat a lot of?
He ate a lot of Indian food, and his best friend and their family was Sri Lankan. So he was constantly eating curries. And when we would go out, he would find these restaurants. And so we'd go out and have a lot of Middle Eastern food. Living in London was a real experience because you can get any kind of food there. And so we tended to concentrate on Middle Eastern food and on Chinese food because we had this great little place in Soho and we'd go in there and it was a routine thing. We'd probably kind of gotten in a rut, but he would read the advertisements, the postings, the new restaurants, and he would try and get us to go to different and have different experiences.
Well, one difference, though, I love Dal, and one time took several transatlantic cruises, but there was one where the chef was Indian and his dal was so delicious. And he would even particularly prepare Indian food for me because he knew I liked it. And every time I thought, okay, I'm not going to have dal today. I had it yesterday and the day before, but I could not help it. It was just so delicious. But one difference, so Tony did like hot curry.
I don't.
Oh, good. No, I didn't care for hot curry either. So you are there in London, you say what you really wanted to do was to change your life significantly. And so we just ask you about some of the ways in which you are changing your life while you're there in Italy. Now, you say that writing is giving you a path toward understanding yourself. And you also say that If somebody writes a memoir, somebody in that memoir has to change and be transformed.
Yes.
And there's a writing group here in Chico, that North State Writers, that I think would really enjoy your book because you offer so many interesting suggestions, really, for writers and why even the average person might benefit from that. So what would you tell people? Rebecca, I don't think I want to write. So what would you tell people is what purpose does, well, for example, your memoir, what purpose does your memoir serve?
That whole question of self-understanding, I started out when I moved there doing a diary, and that was very helpful. And then when I thought in terms of producing it as a memoir, I started out thinking chronological order. And then I realized that that the diary was recounting events. And what I had to do was come up with meaning. What did these events mean for me? What did these what effect were the experiences I was having? And could I put that into a narrative? And by seeing my life sort of as a narrative, a process of transformation, then I came to this understanding of what the whole experience in London was about. Because, of course, I wrote it later, and I had time to process it. So with a memoir, what you have to do is decide, okay, what are you talking about? An autobiography has many, many facets of your life, but a memoir deals with a specific time period or experience, and it's parametered, and you have to make meaning out of that because that's what you're trying to convey to the reader. I find so many people interested in doing memoirs because I think there is this desire to understand one's own life. And really, I've found that this whole process of trying to turn it into a narration with themes and sort of the literary approach of looking at it as a quest, things like that, has been significant in my ability to make sense of my life and make sense of my experiences. You have to stop. You have to think it through. You have to see it in the context of the other events and see it as a sort of meaning-making activity, formalized, I think, in writing memoirs.
My guest is Rebecca Knuth. She is a former academic, a retired professor, and the title of her memoir, London Sojourn, Rewriting Life After Retirement. And you have just made the distinction between, say, an autobiography and a memoir. After a break, I'll continue our conversation with Rebecca Knuth. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, Rebecca Knuth, and she has written a memoir, London Sojourn, Rewriting Life After Retirement. Now, I want to get back to your family. You mentioned you have a son, a daughter-in-law, a grandchild.
Yes.
But I would like to ask you about, I mentioned your dad, who said, Rebecca, who's going to take care of you if you get divorced? But we haven't mentioned your mother.
Ooh,
yes.
My mother is a significant factor in the book, as is my father, because at some point, to be a writer or to be a kind of fully developed person, you have to do an amount of separation. And Virginia Woolf was very good at understanding the dynamics of separating from one's parents. And my separation was complicated with my mother because she was in a nursing home. And so half of me, or not half of me, but a part of me was always worried about her, was tethered to this nursing home. I think there was a certain level of guilt that I was there trying to do this experience move forward in my life, and hers was kind of at the end. And so I was very conflicted, and there's a lot in there about my mother and the effect of this experience and this whole issue of, in a way, what is due to a parent and what you have a responsibility for with yourself. And it's a very tough one.
Well, at one point, you even say you wish your mother would die.
And oh, no. I said, what kind of a person would wish their mother would die?
Yes, yes. But I could understand if a person is suffering and suffering, then you don't really want them to suffer. So you might feel like, oh, my poor mother would be better off if she would die. But yet, you're right. That was actually what you said. Now, I want to ask you something, and you don't have to answer this, but you mentioned as your mother was toward the end of her life, and you said dead people were visiting your mother. And I've heard this from more than one source, but what is your take on the fact that she felt that dead people were visiting her?
They weren't dead to her. They were alive to her. So they would float into her consciousness, like she would think that we should go visit someone that had been dead, or she was hurt that her mother hadn't sent her a birthday present and greetings, even though her mother had been dead 20 years. And this wrung my heart, but it made me realize that older people, really old people, sort of lose some of the parameters and boundaries that sort of define what is real and what is not real. And oftentimes I think it's from their heart or from what they want to be and do, and that comes out verbally. Like my mother once spent 4 hours trying to convince me to get the car and take her for a drive. Well, she hadn't been out of the nursing home for 2 or 3 years. The car was gone. This is incredibly disturbing because you're divided. You want to say, okay, oh, mom, your mother's dead, or, oh, well, we can't go out in the car. On the other hand, how do you tell your mother that her mother's dead if she thinks even for a moment she's alive and that she has the power to determine her life to go out and have a car trip and stuff like that? So what do you say to people under those circumstances? It's a tough one.
Well, that brought back memory for me because the night this person, I didn't know he was going to die that night, but he was looking up toward the ceiling and saying, I see all these people. And in his case, there were a lot of people. And I'd heard stories like this, but I realized now I was in denial. I didn't want to believe that he was, quote, seeing these people because I didn't want to believe that he was going to be joining them. But that actually happened a few hours later. So I think that's advice that people should consider, that you didn't want to say, oh, no, mother, yeah, your mother died, and we don't have that car anymore. Because there may be more truth there than we realize.
That's a very good point you just made. But I think also that is the reality in the moment. And if that gives her satisfaction or something, and if that's a moment of connection with somebody or something important to her, I wasn't going to take that away from her.
So in contrast with your mother's long illness, your father had a sudden heart attack and died. And so how did you say your dad's death in 1983 changed everything?
It changed everything because I had been trying to live up to his expectations and according to kind of his programming, which was that I was supposed to be, a respectable married woman with a job in teaching or nursing. In my case, it was teaching.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And so when he died, I no longer had these, evident and invisible sort of constraints around me. I could imagine, for instance, going back to school or, moving on in my life. For instance, getting a PhD, because my father was a research geologist with a master's after World War II, but he didn't like PhDs.
And
he thought they were basically, out of it, frou-frou types. He was a practical on-the-ground geologist. So if I was going to make some of the choices that I ultimately made, it would have been almost impossible with him still alive and with the influence that he had over me and my idea of authority and correct living and things like that.
Well, my dad didn't have that kind of expectations of me because I was a daughter. He had two sons, and he was much more interested in the professions that my two brothers chose than he was in what I chose. But there was a point after I'd already been in academia for years, and I was thinking, okay, what would I like to get? If I go back to school, what should I study? And I thought, well, these days, everybody needs to know the law. So I applied and started law school. But in the process, before I started law school, my dad said, well, why don't you become a doctor? Mm-hmm. Well, so he did. That was the only time he really made any suggestion as to what career choices that I made. But your dad did have expectations of you.
Absolutely. And they were very narrow expectations. And I hadn't realized how much I'd kind of bought into them until I made that first move. The first move was moving out of this small town where they lived a block away. And I went back and got a master's in Hawaii after he died. And then I fell in love with the whole process of research, writing, being a professor, and never really looked back. So, but that would have been inconceivable in his mind because daughters didn't do that. Your father was unusual that he could see you as a doctor.
My guest is Rebecca Knuth. Her memoir is London Sojourn, Rewriting Life After Retirement. And you at one point say you wanted control over your life. Now, why weren't you in control of your life? It sounds like you were, Rebecca.
I wasn't, but I was sort of locked into a kind of lifestyle. And every time that I would break out of the particular lifestyle that I was in and move on to something else, I found it to be tremendously enriching and exciting. So it was a serial move out of a lifestyle into a different lifestyle, and then after a while into a different lifestyle. Nothing hectic, but very risk-taking and very enhancing to my life. Calibrated risks. I was always a very careful person, but always a sense that I needed to keep moving forward.
Well, I'm going to ask you to read one more paragraph in your book, Rebecca. And this is where you start your paragraph, "I've spent my life looking for a tribe." So would you read that and explain, what did you mean by that, Rebecca?
You want me to read it and
yes.
then
Yes.
Okay. "I've spent my life looking for a tribe. At 12, I identified with fictional characters. In my late teens, I sought out my peers, and as an adult, turned to fellow teachers and librarians. After bonding with other doctoral students, the stakes were raised with an academic career in which I had to forge my own path. As a professor, I wanted to share, to huddle with scholars, to discuss topics of mutual interest and advance scholarship. The International Association of Genocide Scholars took me into the fold enthusiastically, but the association was rife with politics and infighting. The dream of a scholarly family faded. And here I was in London trying to fit in with like-minded readers and writers, especially biographers."
This is my guest, Rebecca Knuth. She was just reading from London Sojourn, Rewriting Life After Retirement. And you say, biographers, you said, "I admire biographers." Why do you admire biographers, Rebecca?
I think it's because biographers tend to have a passion. They tend to become involved with their material, and they tend to tell stories about the people that they're involved with, and they create narrations. And I was trying to, in a sense, be my own biographer. I was always looking for groups I could relate to. And generally, I would find that I would move into that group only so far, but always forged my own path, like my own specialty, which was when I was an academic, I was into violent destruction of books and libraries. And oftentimes, the things that I was interested in, there wasn't a peer group involved. And so I, in a way, learned to be my own tribe. But at various points in my life, I bought into the idea that I needed to have a tribe. And now I don't necessarily think so. I need to have friends. I need to have people who are interested in the same things. But I don't think I need to have a coherent group or defined group.
Thank you, Rebecca. And I think readers of your book, I think your book will cause them to reflect on their own lives. And I want to thank Rebecca for being the guest today and remind listeners the title of her book is London Sojourn, Rewriting Life After Retirement.
Thank you so much for the opportunity to be with you and with all your listeners. Thank you.
And next we have a segment we call The Writer's Room, and it features writers from around the North State.
Train Ride. On the rattling train from Haiphong to Hanoi, we stop amid wails and cries where a dirt track crosses the rails. People move in tight clusters to stare at a tangle of metal half under our hard seat car. Now the means a young cyclist has used to call herself off, according to an ancient man explaining to his deaf wife in loud and imperial French the truth of our solemn delay. Soon an official car responds, no ambulance of our Western expectation. And four soldiers haul the dead woman away, indifferent to her condition. Thus my wife sits weeping at what she cannot accept here. As the train jolts into motion, a child offers her sweets made of black banana paste and peas. Philip Hemingway.
Cartography. So tired, treading every step again of what happened between us. I should have, if only, why? I'm mapping a serpentine coastline, delineating every inlet, stream, rock, fold upon fold. The more accurate I am, longer grows the water's edge. In my attention to detail, it stretches towards infinity. The relief of a bird's eye view, or even better, from the window of a plane. Longer strokes, easier lines. Two imperfect people wanting to connect, unable to do so. Hilary Lindauer Vasey.
For more information on the writers you've just heard, go to mynspr.org and click on the poetry link.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.